I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day in August, the 31st of August. All things political coming up this hour, and Craig Gilbert is our guest. Craig, of course, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. He has another front page story today. Interesting one, Walker losing support from political center, 8-point approval decline led by independents and swing regions. We'll talk more about that with Craig. Also, the governor was making, and presidential candidate, making a lot of news over the weekend with his comments on Meet the Press concerning a northern wall. He's already expressed support for a southern wall to secure the borders, and he said that this idea of a wall separating Canada from the United States is a legitimate issue for us to look at. We'll talk about that. Bernie Sanders gaining ground on Hillary Clinton. She, as you heard, the top news story on NPR, this issue of the emails just won't go away. 7,000 more emails will be released tonight. Will she face a challenge from Joe Biden? We'll talk about her speech before the DNC on Friday in Minneapolis. Ask the question, could Donald Trump be the nominee of the Republicans? We'll talk about all of those issues and whatever you would like to bring up this hour with Craig. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave your comments there. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hi, Craig. Thanks for being with us again, sir.
It's nice to be with you.
Now we have a lot to talk about. Well, let's start with your front page story today. This was, it seems to me, a fairly significant drop for Governor Walker in the polls in the state of Wisconsin. 8 points is pretty big, isn't it?
It is, when you consider just how consistently he'd been polling for 3 years, really. I mean, starting in 2012, 2013, 2014, his numbers were as predictable as they could possibly be. They rarely changed. He had just about kind of half the registered voters in Wisconsin approving of the job he did, and almost that many disapproving on average. So it was just, it was the kind of pattern that we, you know, in some ways you never expected to change given the level of division and how polarized people are over him. So I think that makes the change even more significant, because when you have the kind of support he has from within his own party, you know, it gives you a pretty good floor that you're not likely to go below. That's a big chunk of the electorate that is behind you. And so you really have to start sliding quite significantly among independents to get down to, you know, 40%, 39% where he is right now, and that's what's happened.
Yeah, and is it on the basis of a few issues? If so, what might those be, Craig?
Well, I think it looks like the budget had an impact. There were certainly some proposals in there that were unpopular, the university cuts, some other things didn't poll well. But I think it does have a lot to do. It seems like it has an awful lot to do with his presidential bid and his presidential campaign, and I mean that on a couple of different levels. I mean, one, just the fact that he's not around the state, which means he's not a presence in the state, and two, people know he's not spending all of his time being governor, that he's running for president. And I think, you know, when he was campaigning and on route to winning his election in 2014, when the subject of the presidential campaign came up, he told people that he was really focused on serving out his second term as governor. He didn't make a promise not to run for president, but I think those of us in the political world knew he was going to run for president, but I'm not sure every voter did, and so I think he may just be paying a price for that, because it was really immediately upon getting reelected that he began to lay the groundwork for his presidential campaign. And then also, when you're running for president as he is, when you're seeking the Republican nomination, he is speaking to very conservative Republican voters in places like Iowa and South Carolina. That's not that when you're speaking to those people, you have a different message than when you're talking to voters in the middle of the Wisconsin electorate. And mm-hmm. I think he's also kind of been defined by a different set of issues in the presidential campaign, hot-button cultural issues like immigration and abortion, compared to the kinds of issues that he focused on rhetorically when he was running for governor. So all those things, I think, have contributed To what is, I do believe, is a pretty significant downturn in his polling numbers.
And this number, 63% saying they didn't like his decision to run for the presidency, I thought that Charles Franklin from Marquette University's law school poll's comments were kind of fun. Voters have gotten the sense that he's just not that into us anymore.
Yeah, and it's funny because when people look at what's the effect in your home state if you're a governor running for president, and there's always been debate about whether it has a positive effect in the sense that, you know, it makes people proud to have their governor running for president, or whether it has a negative effect in the sense that, as we're seeing with Governor Walker, there's the sense that the governor's not being governor, and also whatever other kind of blowback comes with running for president. And so I think we're seeing an example of the latter rather than the former. And, you know, things could change. But right now he's kind of struggling on both fronts in terms of the presidential race and his home state standing.
Your article today looked at different parts of the state. Voters who live, you write, outside Milwaukee and Madison, Green Bay, Appleton, La Crosse, Eau Claire, Wausau, Rhinelander, and some of the counties outside Duluth and Twin Cities have been swing parts of the state. But he's losing support in those parts of the state.
Yeah, and what's significant about that is, you know, it's hard to generalize about an area that vast. I mean, we're talking about the northern part, northeastern part of the state, the northern part of the state, the western part of the state. But I think what is significant about it is once you get outside the Milwaukee and Madison media markets, which are so politicized, where so much of those markets are either very red or very blue, you're talking in the rest of the state about a more purple Wisconsin. And you're also talking about some regions that really do swing. They swing between presidential and midterm elections, and they just have they tend to oscillate more, and this has been a big part of his, you know, political success. I mean, some people sort of view Governor Walker's three election victories sort of almost entirely through the prism of his ability to turn out his Republican base and command almost universal support from Republican voters, but there was a lot more to it than that. I mean, he really did well in the Green Bay area. He did well in northern Wisconsin. He did well in some of these elections in parts of western Wisconsin. That really was a significant part of his recipe for victory, that is also where he's lost a lot of support this year in those areas. And so I think those were, you know, voters in those parts of the state tended to be against the recall, which they maybe partly because they viewed it as kind of a Milwaukee-Madison phenomenon. They clearly responded to parts of the governor's message. But right now, I mean, he's gone from, you know, being in the mid-50s to being in the low 40s in those parts of the state. Mm-hmm. So that's I think, a part of what's going on right now.
Subject to change, you cite. Walker telling Chuck Todd on Meet the Press yesterday, when people see the benefits of our reforms just like they did 4 years ago, I think our numbers will go up again.
So that can always happen. You know, you know, it's natural for him to say that because he wants to put the best possible face on the numbers. He could turn out to be right. You know, who knows? You know, for him, it's going to, I think, depend on how he comes out of this presidential campaign. If he doesn't get the nomination, you know, what does he come back to, and how does he approach the rest of his term? So I don't think it's just a matter of whether the dust settling on the budget and, you know, how people perceive some of the things that he's done in his second term. I think it's going to have a lot more to do with, how the rest of his term looks, assuming he doesn't win the nomination. Obviously, if he wins the Republican nomination, this stuff becomes pretty moot, except for the question of can he win the state of Wisconsin as the Republican presidential nominee.
Yeah. Well, let's move to the wall. We'll listen to some comments that he made on Meet the Press. There was a lot of response to this on social media yesterday, and we'll move to Scott Walker in the presidential race, where his numbers are dropping there as well, perhaps due to Donald Trump, and we do have to talk about Donald Trump. But let's listen to what he said about a possible wall with our Canadian neighbor.
Why are we always talking about the southern border and building a fence there? We don't talk about a northern border.
I'm
if this is about securing the border from potentially terrorists coming over?
Well,
do
we
want to build a wall north of the border,
some
too?
People have asked us about that in New Hampshire. They raised some very legitimate concerns, including some law enforcement folks that brought that up to me at one of our town hall meetings about a week and a half ago. So that is a legitimate issue for us to look at. To me, when I brought this up in front of the Citadel, I said there are a couple key things. You need to secure the homeland. You need to go after terrorists around the world, particularly in the Middle East, be it ISIS or Iran or others that are willing to do harm against us. You need to reestablish our friendships with our allies like Israel and the Sunni Arab states that feel just as threatened by Iran as do the Israelis. And we need to rebuild our military. Those were the things we laid out in our speech to the cadets at the Citadel. But to me, it starts with securing the homeland. It wasn't just about building a wall and securing our borders. It was also about making sure our intelligence community has the ability for counterterrorism and the ability to go after the infrastructure they need to protect us.
Well, the response on social media was all about that possible wall. Has he talked very much about that?
No, which was why it was kind of a weird comment, because it was almost like a throwaway line. I mean, and of course, he wasn't literally proposing a wall. He was saying, in answer to a question, that he was indicating that he was open to it, which was obviously enough to kind of stir up a hornet's nest.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a strange comment, given, you know, he is a governor of a state that has close proximity to Canada, and it's not an issue that, you know, that's out there. It's not an issue that people are talking about.
Right.
So it was kind of a, you know, from a purely political standpoint, you could look at it as one in a series of kind of unforced errors on the part of the governor. I mean, he had this very long interview with Meet the Press. And here was one comment that he made that he probably didn't think would become a big deal that, kind of became the headline in a lot of the stories out of that interview. And so I don't think it really served his purposes. But, you know, part of what's been dogging him in this race has been the way he's answered questions like this, either leaving his position kind of ambiguous and unclear, and this is also an example of that, because again, he's saying, I'm not going to do it, but I think it's something worth looking at, just weighing in on stuff, either weighing in on stuff that, you know, maybe he shouldn't have weighed in on, or not answering questions that people expected him to answer. He's just, you know, he's had kind of one hiccup after another,
mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem to be hurting him for a long time when he was doing well in the polling. Now it seems to be catching up with him.
Well, and his polling, when you look at the presidential race, is not very good either, Craig. Is that due to Donald Trump and his being forced to make more hardline positions in a more forceful way because of Trump's pressure?
Yeah, partly. I mean, I think, you know, you can sort of break the Trump effect down into several different things. I mean, there's just, you know, Trump, you know, if he's at 25% of the national polls and a little bit more, a little bit less in some of the state polls, then he's taking that out of everybody, and one of the people that he's taking that out of is Scott Walker, who was in the frontier in these polls before Trump really made his mark on this race. So Scott Walker did have more to lose than some of the other candidates because he was further along. So there's that. There's also just, you know, how do all these candidates look in comparison to Trump? And, you know, in comparison to a, you know, Scott Walker has been accused of having a bland personality by people.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump is just the opposite of that. So there's that. There's all the attention that he just soaks up on a daily basis at the debate, on an ongoing basis in the media. And then there's the reaction. There's how these candidates have chosen to react to Trump. I mean, some of the Republican candidates, like Marco Rubio, have basically tried not to react to Trump in any way. And you've got Jeb Bush kind of mixing it up with Trump, and the jury is still out on that. And then you've got Scott Walker, who has tried for the most part to avoid kind of direct confrontation with Trump, but seems to be very much responding to the Trump phenomenon by trying to play up his kind of anti-establishment credentials in a way that sometimes seems a little strained. I mean, he's, you know, when he talked about, immigration, he was getting into trouble on immigration even before Trump came along, but that's continued with the issue of birthright citizenship. But even things like, well, I was up in New Hampshire with him when he kind of started this new uh, uh, this new way of talking about Act 10 and basically kind of criticizing people in his own party in Wisconsin by saying he had to take on his party's establishment that didn't want to go after the unions, basically suggesting they were too timid and too worried about their own offices and their own careers to want to do it. It was kind of striking to hear that because he hadn't used those words before. And in the end, he had to walk it back to the point where he said he was talking really only about maybe two or three state legislators, which is a far cry from taking on your party establishment. So I think he's gotten himself into trouble in part by the way he's reacted from.
I'm kind of surprised that Marco Rubio has been lost in the shuffle here. He struck me as probably a good Republican candidate, that a lot of the qualifications he has would have been, I would think, attractive to a lot of Americans. But what's happened to him?
Well, I think it's an interesting point of comparison with Scott Walker, because Scott Walker's perceived as, you know, as flailing a little bit on the campaign trail, making some missteps. Marco Rubio, not so much, but they're both, you know, have suffered. And it's not like Marco Rubio is doing a whole lot better than Scott Walker in the polls, but they do share this quality of, in the early polling, they were both candidates who seemed to, you know, have the capacity to appeal to different wings of the party. And it wasn't just that they were this kind of Republican or that kind of Republican, but they seem to have the potential to sort of get the support of both establishment Republicans and grassroots, you know, Tea Party Republicans or maybe evangelicals. And in a way, I think they've both fallen victim to a very large and fragmented field where, you know, you're squeezed on all sides. If you're competing for the Tea Party vote, then well, there's somebody out there, maybe Ted Cruz, who can out-Tea Party you. And if you're competing for the evangelical vote, well, maybe there's somebody like Ben Carson or Mike Huckabee that can out-evangelical you. And if you're competing for the populist, you know, anti-establishment vote, well, there's Donald Trump, and he's got you there. And then if you're trying to appeal as well to moderates, well, here comes John Kasich, who can do that pretty well.
Right.
Or establishment Republicans, there's Jeb Bush. So, in a way, I think that's part of the problem for both those guys. You look at the field, it's just amazing how
I know.
How muddled and unstructured it is, and seemingly less so every day. I mean, there's just no one who appears to have the inside track to the nomination, assuming, I mean, if you believe that Donald Trump has real barriers to getting the nomination, which I think most people in the political world do, and then you say, okay, well, let's just say, here's a thought experiment. It's not going to be Donald Trump. Who's it going to be? And you look at the rest of the field, and it's very difficult to make a compelling argument for any individual candidate having the inside track to the nomination.
So could Donald Trump be the nominee of the Republicans?
I think it's still very, very difficult for a couple of reasons. You know, the party establishment really doesn't want him, and that matters. I mean, that matters in terms of delegates. It matters. It obviously doesn't matter in terms of money because he's got money. You could have a big segment of the party, you know, rallying around one-on-one candidate just in order to prevent Donald Trump from getting the nomination. And he's certainly taken positions that are anathema to certain parts of the party. So it's hard to imagine. I mean, it's obviously could happen, but it's still kind of hard to imagine. And while in this last, you know, in the recent Iowa polling, he certainly improved his standing with voters in that state, there's still a pretty big percentage of Republicans in these polls who don't like him and wouldn't vote for him. So the question is, you know, does he have a ceiling that he's already reaching? Can he still keep going higher? We can talk some more about the Trump phenomenon and why he has the support that he has, but I still think it would be a surprise if he ended up as the nominee.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to that because I do want to ask you that. But what about this element, and I know it's not the majority of Republicans who really like him, but this whole surge, huge crowds for Donald Trump, huge crowds for Bernie Sanders. I can't remember an election fairly recently or in the not-too-distant past, Craig, where you had this real anti-party establishment feeling among people who are voters, and they're showing up for these guys in huge numbers.
Well, I guess I would differ with you a little bit there. I mean, I think, you know, Howard Dean certainly qualifies. I think Pat Buchanan qualifies. It wasn't all that long ago that he kind of commanded a constituency in the Republican Party that probably has some overlap with the Trump phenomenon. You had Ross Perot as an independent candidate doing that as well. And so I think it's not a new thing. And, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, how far, you know, what happens with the Bernie Sanders candidacy. But I think we've certainly seen in the past, especially in the Democratic Party, but at times in the Republican Party, this kind of phenomenon where it's really kind of it feels like a rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton for a moment. More emails being released tonight. She just can't get away from this email controversy.
Yeah, it's, you know, whatever you think about the email controversy, it's now to a point where because it's kind of embedded now in the legal machinery, that poses all sorts of dangers for her, the drip danger, mm-hmm. but also just the kind of independent machinery of investigation that with an uncertain and unpredictable end to it that she can't control. So that's all obviously poses a lot of peril for her.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for the campaign, Craig?
Well, who knows? I mean, it means that she still has considerable political assets that she brings as a potential Democratic nominee, but she's also got this big cloud hanging over her. So we're in kind of a limbo, I think, where there are Democrats, certainly in the activist community and the Democratic establishment, who are just watching and waiting to see how bad it gets, how serious it gets, and they're kind of evaluating. I mean, they're you know, making a kind of a running evaluation subject, you know, week to week about how much of a risk this poses.
Is that what Joe Biden is doing as well?
I think so. Mm-hmm. He's got a really, you know, he's got to, you know, come to some judgments about his own viability and about how weak and vulnerable Hillary Clinton is if he's thinking about getting into it.
We welcome phone calls. Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour of the program. He has a front page story today, another one, this one, analyzing what's happening with Walker's support here in the state of Wisconsin. Walker losing support from the political center. His numbers have fallen precipitously since April. Why is that the case? He's also losing support in his presidential run. Why is that the case? We'll get back to Craig on who are the people who are attracted to Donald Trump? What's his base? Could he be the nominee of the party? What about Hillary Clinton? Will this email controversy, I like his description, it's kind of a drip, and you might have investigations, and it's going to be with her for some time. What does that do to her campaign? What about Bernie Sanders? Does it make the sense to think that maybe he could be a nominee with his growing support and his huge crowds or not? Well, we welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome your phone calls for all things political. 800-486-8655 is our number, and John in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, John.
Well, let's take a few of these issues today. Why is Walker falling in the polls? Because he is a union-hating, union-busting loon. He is the Richard Nixon of this generation. And the people in this state and the people around the country can see through this. In terms of crowds, Kathleen, you remember 1984, Madison, Wisconsin, Geraldine Ferraro. You had more people show up for her than you could count. And the Democrats still lost that election. And the whole thing with Trump, he will not be the nominee of this party, of the Republican Party. There is no way that he is going to sustain any type of long-term viability because he doesn't have the intellectual capacity to make dispassionate and reasonable arguments.
Craig.
Well, I think, I mean, there's a lot of interesting discussion and debate among people in the political world about what the Trump phenomenon represents. You know, some people have argued that it's all about, that it really doesn't have any content, that it's just about his kind of attitude and his style, and it's that kind of defiance and not being politically correct and being willing to say anything and not talking and sounding like a politician. Other people have looked at it through the prism of, you know, particularly of immigration and appealing to people that are super angry about immigration. And then the argument's also been made, which I think is an interesting one, is that Trump is actually kind of speaking to a group within the party that is really kind of disconnected from the party establishment, but people that are kind of more populist in their economic viewpoints. They're, you know, they're opposed to cutting Social Security. They may be open to tax cuts on the wealthy, but they kind of marry those more liberal positions on economics with more conservative positions on culture, like immigration and some other things, and that's kind of like the inverse of the leadership and the elites in the Republican Party, who were very conservative on the economic issues and more moderate on the social issues. And so that argument is that Trump has actually, you know, found a market niche that has, you know, some foundation within the Republican Party, but the Republican candidates don't normally tap into because it's so at odds with the leadership of the party. So, you know, I think we're going to find out as this thing plays out, you know, which of these theories is the most convincing about Trump. But I don't think you can say it's entirely just personality, although personality clearly has a lot to do with it. I was at a Trump rally in New Hampshire, and it's like being at a carnival.
Really?
I mean, the entertainment value is a huge piece of that, a huge piece of his draw. And when you ask people, you know, what they like about Trump, it's just, you know, they talk about, you know, his willingness to sort of say whatever he thinks and call people out and be politically incorrect, and it sort of seems to be kind of expressing this real frustration, you know, with politics and with the political leadership. And I think the one thing that, you know, maybe, you know, the Sanders phenomenon and the Trump phenomenon have in common is that, you know, we've been living in an era of divided government where neither party can really satisfy their base, or anybody else for that matter, because they can't do anything. You know, Republicans can stop the president from doing the stuff he wants to do, and the president can stop Republicans from doing the stuff they want to do, and it makes everybody across the spectrum unhappy, and it creates, I think, an appetite for people who are very defiant and rebellious and have that kind of edge that appeals to people who are really frustrated.
Yeah, but that edge is frequently so off the mark. I mean, this whole thing about the birther, and he carried that on and carried it on, and he was wrong about that, and this immigration idea is really smacks of extreme nastiness. He's playing into something else that's, isn't he? There has been talk that, well, people are worried about this becoming a minority nation, and that's what he's tying into.
No, I think there's some of that. You know, how much of that is driving it, I don't know. But I think that's part of the explanation for what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's the entire explanation.
Thanks, John, for the call. We go to Claire in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. As much as I'd like to see a woman president next time, I think the difference between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump is dramatic, to say the least. Bernie Sanders might come across as a boring old white man, but if you see him speak, this man has passion, and he speaks reasonable things. I guess my point was going to be to get Mr. Gilbert's opinion on this. It seems like the quote-unquote mainstream media has really not given Bernie much much of his due. He gets one line here and there in the news, and, you know, of course, that Black Lives Matter episode gave him some coverage that was pretty extensive, but his message is resonating with people, and he's passionate, and he's reasonable, versus Donald Trump is kind of, you know, saying whatever comes to the top of his head at the moment. And I'd like to get Mr. Gilbert's take on what the mainstream media thinks about Bernie and why he's getting so little coverage.
All right, Claire. Thanks.
Well, he's also different from Donald Trump in that he actually is a politician, and Donald Trump isn't. So, you know, he's a sitting U.S. senator, so he's got a record, and he's got a, you know, a career, a political career, which makes him, you know, not the outsider in the way that Donald Trump is someone on the, completely on the outside, kind of ripping the political system and process from the outside. I do think, you know, I think he's getting coverage. I think it's hard to generalize about the media these days. I mean, even the mainstream media. But I do think it's true that there continues to be some skepticism in the political media about, you know, how far Bernie Sanders can take this, because people have, you know, we do have a history on the Democratic side of you know, candidates like Bernie Sanders getting traction and appealing to a segment in the party and drawing crowds, but then not being able to convert that into a meaning, you know, into a real, not in the end being a real threat to win the nomination. And, you know, we've had a phenomenon like that in most cycles, or more often than not. And so I think, yes, I think if you polled political journalists or mainstream political journalists and said, can Bernie Sanders win the Democratic nomination, I bet that most of them would say no. So that is going to affect his coverage. But I do think he is getting coverage, and I also think ultimately, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. And if he continues to draw support, draw crowds, and then, you know, so much of what this process is right now, the invisible primary, is picked apart and poured over and ultimately is overtaken by events, which is when people start voting. And it does matter. What happens now matters in terms of organization and fundraising and laying the foundation for candidates. But when people start voting, everything really changes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the history has been that, you know, the polls and the landscape in these races in January or February of next year is going to look nothing like it looks right now.
We've had several emails from people wondering why it was okay for Clinton predecessors to use their personal emails, and it's not okay for her.
Well, that's, again, in the eye of the beholder. I mean, that's part of her argument. I'm not as expert on the nuts and bolts of this issue as probably some other guests you've had on. But it's my understanding that the policies within the State Department have shifted over time, and so it depends on, you know, who you're talking about and when you're talking about. But I think it's certainly, you know, one reason why, you know, people look at this through a different lens is what the caller brings up.
Thanks, Claire, for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Kathleen, I was wondering if you and your guests could give me your opinions on if Donald Trump is nominated as the Republican nominee for president, how many independents and Democratic, traditional Democratic voters would switch over to vote for him?
Oh, it's really hard to know. I mean, you'd really have to examine both sides of that equation, right? Because, you know, are there Republicans who would switch over and vote for the Democrat? And then is that number bigger or smaller than the number of Democrats who would switch over and vote for him? I mean, we've been in an era in our politics where there's not a lot of that kind of switching going on. So, I mean, it's not to say it can't happen just because it hasn't happened. It hasn't been happening. But, you know, ever since the Perot movement, you know, there's been less ticket splitting. There's been less crossover voting. I mean, you've seen it in the state of Wisconsin in a very dramatic way. It doesn't mean we can't ever get back to that, but that hasn't been the recent history. And so I think it would take an extraordinary set of circumstances to have large numbers of voters, you know, kind of just abandoning their partisan tendencies and voting for a candidate in the other party.
Let's talk a little bit, going back to the analysis of Governor Walker's poll numbers, those independent, lean Republican voters. He's lost so much of their support in this state. Where are those voters politically? Are they leaning Republican still? Are they endorsing anybody at this point? Are they still making up their minds?
You mean nationally or in the state?
Well, I wonder if you can look at both.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, these are people in the poll that when they were asked what their affiliation was, their first answer was independent. But then when they were asked, well, if you're granted you're an independent, do you lean toward one party or another? And then at that point they say, yeah, I lean toward the Republican Party. So they're, you could call them soft Republicans. You could call them Republican-leaning independents. And sometimes they get counted often as part of as independent voters. But one reason why it's always tricky to write about and analyze the independent vote is the independent vote always contains a lot of people, maybe even a majority of people, who tend to go one way or the other. They call themselves independents because they have reservations about a political party, and they're not pure partisans, but they tend to vote on one side or the other. So that's why when you hear that, you know, when 30 or 40% of the voters say they're independents, they're not really. I mean, it's really, the true independents are really a much smaller number, maybe like 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So again, these are people that are still, majority of whom are still supporting Scott Walker in this case, but it's not, you know, instead of 85%, it's 69%, something like that. So that's a significant decline. And again, these are people that are probably in the end, the vast majority of them are going to vote Republican, but it does matter, you know, whether you're, I mean, those kinds of defections really do matter, because it's a big difference between getting, you know, 90, 95% of the vote within your own party and right. getting 85%. That's a lot of votes. Yeah. And so this is a part of the electorate that can really, even though they're not pure electorate, pure swing voters, they can really have an impact either by staying home or switching over and mm-hmm. voting for the other side.
Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Gilbert is our guest. He is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
And it's good to talk to you again, Mr. Craig Gilbert. I enjoy your every time you're on the show. Really,
thank you.
You really bring a lot of good insights, and I appreciate that. The question I have, well, first of all, I'd just like to mention that it's one of, you know, when you go out, when you're exiting email and they throw up those little teaser links hoping you'll click on it. Well, there was one that I didn't click on, but I thought was interesting, and it was to the effect, is Donald Trump rich enough to run as an independent party candidate? In other words, with the ever escalating cost of elections, would he, you know, and the some questions about what his real worth actually is, could he actually afford to do that? Which I think is a commentary in and of itself. But the other thing I heard yesterday on All Things Considered Sunday afternoon was one of their analysts who had been doing polling or looking at polling of likely Republican voters. And he said a similar thing was going on with Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party, but that there was really striking about the Republican Party was that not only are these voters, is Trump's approval rating going up with these voters, but the percentages of those voters who had formerly really disliked him are suddenly switching in dramatic form and saying, yeah, he'd be okay.
Well, that certainly happened in Iowa. I mean, there's one very respected, probably the most respected Iowa poll came out over the weekend that's done by the Des Moines Register and Bloomberg by a woman named Ann Seltzer, who's been polling in Iowa for a long time. It's really hard to poll there because the percentage of people that actually go and participate in these caucuses is really small. So you got to do a lot of work to identify that small segment of the electorate and not oversample those people. And she does that better than anybody. And that was the real stunner in her last poll, was that his, we call them faves, unfaves. I mean, the proportion of people that view him favorably and unfavorably really turned around between their last two polls. So, yes, he got his likability really went up and his negatives really declined, which is pretty profound.
Yes.
And, you know, it remains to be seen whether that's happening across the board or not. But that's one of the things that you would think would have to happen if he's going to become a viable threat to win the Republican nomination.
Just one more quick thing. So you mentioned the Des Moines Register. In our paper over here in La Crosse, they picked up an op-ed column from a reporter for the Register, and she was describing in such amazingly stark detail. I get, you know, obviously not being a politician, Trump doesn't have a voting record, but Trump has written two books, one in 2000 and one in 2011. And right before, of course, he was toying with running for president against Obama in 2012. Anyhow, on all of these issues, gay rights and marriage, immigration even, the woman's right to choose, right on down the line, he just flipped every one of them. Every point that now he's out there espousing so vocally, he was completely against in his first book. And so, you know, I guess, you know, he could probably argue, well, I've evolved in my positions. But at some point, don't you think that this would give a lot of fodder for the attack ads?
Yeah, you would think. But, I mean, so far he's managed to kind of play by his own rules. And it hasn't, that kind of stuff hasn't hurt him. I mean, I think some of the people that are expressing support for him are probably aware that he's changed positions. They're probably aware that he's taking positions that maybe they don't agree with. But right now the appeal is strong enough for those people to just overlook that. And this will be one of the kind of interesting storylines and dramas going forward, is at what point, if and when, that history catches up with him.
More phone calls in a moment. Craig Gilbert is our guest. Thanks, Scott, for your call. It's All Things Political. Craig is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief and has, well, everything he writes is good. And he's got something today, if you're looking for something timely, in the continuing the Wisconsin voter. And this looks at what's happening with Governor Walker losing support from the political center here in the state of Wisconsin. Why is that happening is another question we touched on earlier. So we'll return and take more of your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. And Victor in West Allis is next. Hey, Victor.
Hi, enjoying the program. I have one question, one comment. My first question is, how come the three major networks only concentrate on three candidates? Can you only hear anything about the other candidates? And for a political tactical point of Donald Trump, he's doing everything so beautifully by coming up with his controversial comments. I just figure he's going to save a lot of money on campaign ads.
Yeah, well, in terms of the networks, I mean, they, you know, that's all, I think, pretty predictable. I mean, the networks are, you know, kind of trying to speak to a broad audience, and they're gonna cover the best known candidates that people know and are hearing about. You got to remember that we're still fairly early in this process, that's going to change, and the things that are happening right now are not determinative of what's going to be happening next January, February, and March. I mean, this is like a sequential process where, you know, traditionally it does make it possible for candidates to kind of inject themselves, you know, into the story, and by surprising people in the early contests and generating momentum, and then gaining the kind of coverage that is helpful and also can be hurtful. But I guess I'm not too worried about the fact that not all the candidates are getting time on the networks. I mean, part of this is a function of just this sort of massive field, and you saw in the dynamics of the first debate in Cleveland just how hard it is to to spread the time, and how hard it is for people. It's a war for attention out there. I mean, Scott Walker's big undoing in that debate was just kind of not doing enough to put himself on people's radar screens in that debate. He just had, he answered the questions, but he didn't command attention. Mm-hmm. And when there's 10 people on stage and 17 people in the race, you know, you have to command attention.
Thanks, Victor. Bill in Madison. Hi.
I was just wondering if we might be entering a period such so close to the 1840s and 50s where you had groups like the abolitionists, the nativists, the hard currency people, and that kind of splitting and restructuring the political parties?
You know, I think you have to, I mean, anything is possible, and I you know, as a political reporter, I try to be open to the fact that, you know, what we see tomorrow is not just going to simply be a repeat of what we saw yesterday. At some point, you know, parties do shift and realign and things change and patterns change. So I think you have to be open to that. I don't know that that's what's happening right now. And I do think, I think you do have to kind of keep in mind our recent history this isn't all brand new. I mean, again, there have been candidates before who had these arcs in the year before the primary. There have been non-traditional candidates who did well and commanded attention. We haven't had a field quite this big on the Republican side before. I mean, that's certainly new. And I think, you know, you could argue that part of what's going on here is just a not very positive reflection on the Republican field. I mean, it's really the inability of any of the so-called, you know, traditional candidates to really set themselves apart in this large field and kind of hang on to what they had in the early going or consolidate support. I mean, we just haven't, no one's shown the ability to do that, which doesn't mean it won't happen. But, you know, part of the Trump phenomenon is taking advantage of this vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Somebody did, I think it was McClatchy, did some interviews with people who were attending the DNC conference in Minneapolis over the weekend, and their comments were, the people we fear the most as Democrats in this race would be Jeb Bush or John Kasich. Are they right about that in a matchup with Hillary Clinton, or does that change with somebody else that those would be the more formidable opponents?
You know, if I were a Democrat, I wouldn't bet my house on those kinds of calculations, because you just never know. And I think, and it's just so hard to say at this point. I mean, who would make the best candidate? I mean, I can understand someone sort of saying, well, John Kasich would be tough because he might peel away some, you know, he might do well with independents and moderates. He might peel away some Democrats, but, you know, it would be a very unpredictable candidacy. I mean, John Kasich, you know, has a reputation in Ohio of being kind of temperamental, and you don't know where that's going to take him as a candidate. Jeb Bush, I think, you know, some Democrats think Jeb Bush would not be a tough candidate to run against, particularly if Hillary's the nominee, because it would kind of diffuse the whole, they might view it as diffusing the whole, neutralizing the Hillary's problem as being this old name and the old dynasty thing. So, you know, at this point, and I would certainly not pay any attention to the polls that you know, the polling of hypothetical head-to-head general election matchups next year, which have just no meaning at all at this point. I just think we have no idea right now who would be the strong candidates and who would be the weak candidates. I think we have some idea who would be the riskiest candidates in the sense of just being really unpredictable, and who would really kind of blow things up. In that sense, and being unpredictable, but I don't think I doubt there's even a consensus within the Democratic Party about which candidate they want to face in November.
Hmm. Oh, it's a long process, isn't it, Craig?
It is very long.
Is it too long?
Well, I think you just got to pace yourself. I think there's a reason why I've learned. That's what I've learned as a reporter, and I think there's a reason why most normal people, you know, aren't living and breathing this stuff in August of the year before the election,
right.
Whereas some people in the political world are. So you sort of have to take it as it comes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for
nice
being with us.
You.
Yeah, nice to be with you. Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. He also writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. We thank him for his time. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program and on-air production as well. I'm going to be out tomorrow just for a day, and John Munson will be sitting in another political kind of conversation discussing how Google could rig the 2016 presidential election. He'll be discussing search engine manipulation effect, and that's coming up tomorrow during this hour. So all of you political junkies, tune in again tomorrow. Well, all the time, but tomorrow too for that segment. Well, we have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll be asking the question hour two. And please tell me how you answer this. What is the purpose of college? To learn, or to find a job?